In this second hour of Midday Friday, more reaction to today's historic Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage. We speak with Martha Ertman, an expert in family law at the University of Maryland School of Law, whose book recounting her own same-sex marriage has just been published. We'll speak to Martha Ertman about what the decision will mean for families and how it will affect family law. Plus, it's the 40th anniversary of the first summer blockbuster, Jaws. Midday film critics Christopher Reed and Linda DeLibero join us for a look back to 1975 at Steven Spielberg's legendary thriller and pop culture classic. First, the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, Midday Friday. Dan Roderick's here. Additional emails on the red line. Tracy in Baltimore saying this city desperately needs a more complete transit system, and the red line represented a major step towards that goal. I fear that to the governor's decision to kill this project after expending so much time, energy, and effort researching, planning, and garnering support will set transit in this region back for years. I see so much potential and so many assets in this city, and I find it disheartening when our state officials and fellow citizens fail to support these assets or even disparage the region as something not worth investing in. On a happier note, I am thrilled at the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States to recognize same-sex marriage. I can't wait to officially celebrate the weddings of my gay and lesbian friends. From Tracy. Dan Roderick's here for the second hour of our show. A little bit more comment about this historic decision today by the Supreme Court. First from Kevin Naff, who's been on our show before, editor and co-owner of the Washington Blade. And Kevin, I'm sure you're quite happy with this decision today.
Yeah, I'm glad you called now and not 2 hours ago because I was in tears then. But I have pulled it together, and yeah, it's an incredible day.
And in Maryland, I guess, you know, we've established gay marriage here. It's been, 3 years now since the referendum vote. But it doesn't feel anticlimactic to you. I thought in the earlier hour it was starting to feel that way based on some of the reactions we were getting.
Oh, gosh, no. No, this is huge. This decision will be studied and talked about for hundreds of years. This is an incredible moment for our country. There's still a lot of work ahead, but today is a day to celebrate. And you know, I think back just 10 years ago to the 2004 election when George Bush so cynically ran a campaign largely in opposition to gay marriage, and mm-hmm. he ran on amendments in 11 different swing states opposing gay marriage, and use it as a wedge issue. And now, 10 years later, we have the Democrats doing the opposite, using marriage as an issue to pummel the Republicans with. How dare you not support equality? It's really just an unbelievable turnabout.
It is, and that's a blink of time that you're describing there.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I'm glad we got to touch base today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Kevin Naff, and sure, that's the Washington Blade. You can go there and see their report on this. I also want to welcome to the show Professor Martha Ertman of the University of Maryland School of Law to talk about this decision today. Martha Ertman is an expert in family law, and she just published a book. Well, she didn't publish it, but she wrote it. Her publisher just published a book called Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. And the book is part memoir and part about family law. Martha Ertman, thank you for making time to join us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I say the book is part memoir because in it you recount your own same-sex marriage, right?
Indeed, I do. And in fact, it shows how fast the marriage quality map has changed. When I asked the woman who's now my wife, Karen, to marry me, we live in the District of Columbia, and we could not have gotten married there. So we went up to Massachusetts, where I'm from. But by the time we were back from our honeymoon, we could have gotten married in the District of Columbia. And then by the time we celebrated our fourth anniversary, The federal government recognized it after the Windsor case, and now we're about to celebrate our sixth. And I'm amazed how fast this has all happened, given that both of us are in our early 50s. And when we were in law school, it could be a crime to be gay. This has all changed in our adult lifetime, and it's just wonderful to see how law has moved much more quickly than its usual dinosaur pace to reflect how people are actually living their lives.
It is head spinning, and
it's extraordinary.
Even though we lived through it, you know, what explains it? What explains
that
turnabout?
Was an interesting question. Some people think it's about gay people, and I really don't think so. Much as I'd like to think gay people, I've been, you know, out since the 80s. I would love to think gay people are that powerful, but I think the larger culture is changing, that it's very much because the whole relationship between men and women and this organization of families is changing, that we need a new logic, that the outdated logic of a status that's unchanging, that's ordained by God, is just too inflexible for the way that the world is changing. So the society has changed from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. That's changing the how much money men and women bring into the household. And so it's really good for everybody. It's kind of like wheelchair ramps. We've got wheelchair ramps for wheelchairs, but then everybody else finds out, oh, it's great for baby carriages and it's great for wheelie luggage.
Right. What did you think of Justice Kennedy's majority opinion? What did you think of some of the language in there? Some of the language is really beautiful, isn't it?
Isn't it? It's lyrical. Lyrical is the word, and it brought a tear to me too, because my personal history is I used to cry in law school classroom, sitting next to the most conservative man in my class, and he also would cry because it was so unfair, these old, outdated views of gay people. And so it's amazing to have the highest court in our land. Scholars talk about the expressive function of law, so that when the highest court in the land talks about new generations recognizing new dimensions of freedom, it is talking not just about same-sex marriage and gay people. It's really talking about what kind of culture we live in and how the humanity of all kinds of people is recognized, and that we're really a better country because of it.
And today, so you're reflecting on this. I was thinking of President Obama, too, a decision he made, 4 or 5 years ago on the Defense of Marriage Act that sort of pushed things along. He was the first president since that act was enacted to reverse.
Oh, I think he's, yeah.
Yeah, that was a pretty important moment, too, wasn't it?
Huge, huge. I think he's the president who's done more for the equality of LGBT people than anyone else. And so on the one hand, I'd love to just, you know, canonize.
Oh, did we lose Martha? Oh, I don't know why that happens, folks. I apologize for it, but I think we're about the end of our time with her anyway. Martha Ertman, who is on the West Coast someplace, right? Yeah, we lost her. Martha Ertman, an expert in family law with the University of Maryland, Francis King Carey School of Law, and her book, I'll mention it again, Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. This is the Midday Friday Show. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll get to our Midday on Film segment with Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro. June 20th, 1975, Jaws hit the movie theaters, and we're celebrating or noting and talking about the 40 years since Jaws, Steven Spielberg's classic, premiered. The Jaws summer of 75. You may have memories you want to share about going to the beach that summer. 410-662-8780. This is Midday Friday. We'll be right back. Yes, June 20th, 1975. A little-known director by the name of Steven Spielberg premiered his second theatrical feature, Jaws, based on Peter Benchley's best-selling novel. The film was a phenomenal box office mega hit. Some even call it the first summer blockbuster. In fact, Linda DeLibro, a Midday film critic, made that argument on the show a couple of years ago when we were talking about summer blockbusters. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Dan.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you.
And Christopher Llewellyn Reed is with us again from Stevenson University, Linda at Hopkins, and it's time for Midday on Film. And what a this is a great delicacy. I love Shark. Anyway, Chris, nice to see you.
Great to be here, Dan, and I love this movie.
Is this a summer blockbuster?
It is. And
I mean, is it the original summer blockbuster?
We could call it that because it's the film, along with Star Wars 2 years later, that really sort of helped create the era that we still find ourselves in of wide release summer films that are called blockbusters because the line goes all the way around the block. And this was the first film that really set that model.
That's why it's called a blockbuster?
Well, it comes from the idea of cluster bombs in World War II, right, which would sort of take out an entire block, and then that became applied to these kinds of films that would basically, you know, have a line that goes all the way around the block.
Yes.
Thank you for mentioning that.
That's right.
What did people do for movies in the summer before that? Were there summer releases?
Well, the word was that people did not go to the movies in the summer, which is kind of stupid because people go to the movies to get out of the heat, especially back in the day when air conditioning wasn't, you know, extant.
Right, and kids aren't in school.
Right. Kids actually played outside.
Back in the day, they did. Yeah, that's right.
But that was kind of, you know, that was when you released all your stinkers and your big nothing movies. And then, you know, Jaws is a first for several reasons, one of which was this idea of opening wide instead of building an audience. You would open in New York and L.A. and then gradually spread across the country with a film. And Lou Wasserman, who's the legendary head of Universal Pictures and had been a longtime Hollywood agent, a power broker, decided that, you know, this was kind of a, they didn't think of this as an important property. It was kind of a disaster movie and cheapo. Of course, it didn't turn out to be that cheap. But he decided that we're just going to open this everywhere all at once. Hmm. So he opened in 500 theaters, I think, to begin with, which was a lot of theaters back in the day. And that kind of release was novel. And it was also novel to use so much television advertising, which was not the thought was in Hollywood that people who watch TV didn't go to the movies. So why advertise movies on television? Which, again, you look back on that and you think, well,
yeah, that sounds crazy. Right.
But
a well-produced trailer.
Exactly. Yeah. And they had a really great trailer, and it really did the trick. And from then on, it was TV all the way for advertising.
Yeah, they had a really great trailer voiced by Percy Rodriguez, who was this wonderful voice of artist of the time. You know, Lou Wasserman may not necessarily believe that this film is going to make a lot of money, but the two producers, Brown and Zanuck, really believed in this property from the get-go because they'd actually purchased the rights to the book.
And the book had been a bestseller, right?
But they purchased the rights before it was even published.
So oh, really?
Sort of latched onto it early on. So they had faith, and they had faith in Spielberg, who was a sort of untested director.
Well, talk about him a bit. Would you, 1975, this was his second theatrical
release. He'd made a first sort of feature-length film for TV called Duel.
Great film.
Which got a theatrical release in Europe and helped sort of establish him over there as a talent to reckon with, and then that then had influence on his reputation in the States. He'd sort of been called Sheinberg's Folly for Sid Sheinberg, who was one of the producers at MCA Universal, had hired him to sort of do TV episodes when he was very young, and he was only slowly starting to demonstrate the talent that Sid Sheinberg had always believed in. So he'd made a film that didn't make a lot of money, Sugarland Express, with Goldie Hawn and William
Atherton.
That
was his first film?
First theatrically released film in the United States. And that was produced by Zanuck and Brown as well. And so they knew that he had talent, and they were willing to give him a chance to make a film that almost sunk his career before it started because, as Linda was saying, it went over budget and over schedule. But those two producers had enough faith in him, and Sid Sheinberg did as well, that they were able to kind of stand behind him. And the film got released in June of 1975 and made history.
So, Linda, I'm trying to think now whether I saw a Jaws commercial on TV or just it created this buzz and people wanted to go. I remember standing in line to see it in a movie theater in New York. I spent the summer in New York, and we stood in line to get in to see it and being really frightened by the film, really scared by the movie. Yep. The part that, I'll tell you about the part that scared me the most. But do you remember the first time you saw it?
Yes, I do. And it's funny because at the time, my feeling about the 70s movies and the new Hollywood was, you know, these were the great directors, and I was lucky enough to grow up at a time when people like Robert Altman and Martin Scorsese and Michael Cimino and all these
Coppola,
and they were making serious pictures, beautiful artistic films that were also, you know, many of them making pretty good money. And Jaws came along, and I remember thinking right away, oh, this is the end of all of that.
Yeah, right.
This is
going to be a cheesy thriller, right?
I love the film now. Yeah. I can appreciate its glories much more than I could back when I was a kid. But back then, I remember thinking, oh, God, this is stupid.
I can see that
sequence. Even though I'm sure I was terrified by it myself and enjoyed it.
How about you, Chris?
Well, I saw it later. I'm born in 1969, so my parents didn't let me go see Jaws when it came out in 1975 as a six-year-old. And when
what
I did,
was its rating?
It was rated PG.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you
could have.
I could have, but I'm glad that they didn't let me see it. And that I think I was about 10 or 11 when I finally saw it. And from that point on, I've always... even though I go swimming in the ocean, but I can never forget the film Jaws when I'm in the ocean. And sometimes I swim very quickly if the water is especially murky.
May I say something?
Yes.
I spoke with a young man today who was born in 1979, and he said he grew up worried about sharks because of the film. Mm-hmm. And compared to my life, we didn't think about that. I grew up 20 minutes from a beach and went to the beach all the time, but that was just not in my head. But this kid grew up, and you grew up thinking about that.
Yeah, I grew up in the post-Jaws era, basically, and so it's impossible not to think about what's in the water.
What do you have for us? Can we hear a clip?
Absolutely.
Eager to hear what you brought for us today.
Let's get right into it. So the film begins with a young woman, Chrissy, played by an islander. It was shot on Martha's Vineyard, and many of the incidental characters are played by local vineyard actors. So this young woman, Chrissy, as in the book by Peter Benchley, is killed by the shark, and the new chief of police, played by Roy Scheider, Chief Brody, discovers the body on the beach after the boy that she was swimming with alerts them to her being missing. And tries to shut down the beaches. But, of course, the 4th of July is just around the corner, and Amity Island cannot afford to have their beaches closed on the 4th of July because they make all their money in the summer. So he is surrounded on a ferry. It's actually the Chappaquiddick Ferry on Martha's Vineyard. And the mayor of the town, played by Murray Hamilton, in this speech, explains to him why, and Murray Hamilton was Mr. Robinson in The Graduate, explains to Roy Scheider why there's no way he can close the beaches.
Amity is a summer town. We need summer dollars. If the people can't swim here, they'll be glad to swim at the beaches of Cape Cod, the Hamptons, Long Island.
That doesn't mean we have to serve them up a smorgasbord.
Well, we never had that kind of trouble in these waters.
Well, what else could have done that to that girl? Boat the belly?
Well, I think possibly, a boating
accident. That's not what you told me over the phone.
I was wrong. We'll have to amend our reports.
And you'll stand by that?
I'll stand by you.
Right. A summer girl goes swimming. Swims out a little far. She tires. Fishing boat comes along.
It's happened before.
I don't think you appreciate the gut reaction people have to these things.
Harry, I appreciate it. I'm just reacting to what I was told.
Martin, it's all psychological. You yell barracuda. Everybody says, huh? What? You yell shark. We've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July.
Yeah, baby. We know those words.
Oh, mouthing them along with the actors.
And just this week, Linda, Chris and I both spotted this news story from North Carolina. Some beach community down there, they've had 4 shark bites in 2 weeks, the latest an 8-year-old boy. But the town manager, quoted in an Associated Press story, says that they had no intention of telling anybody about the shark bites. Now, you know, you could assume that people will hear about it on the news, but the town had no intention to officially let everybody know about that. It reminded me of the mayor of Amity.
It threatens summer dollars.
Yeah, right. I wanted to ask you both this before we go to the next clip. a comment and then a question. Since the film was made, there's been films made about the making of the film. There's books about it. There's lots of photographs showing the shark, the mechanical shark. And I saw some photographs today of Spielberg, you know, dealing with the machinery of that, right? And for many years, I did not want to see it. I refused to look at those things that showed you the making of Jaws because I just didn't want to know about the tubes and the pumps and the hydraulics of the mechanical shark.
His name's Bruce.
Bruce, right, yeah. I didn't want to see all that. I've changed my mind lately, but I'm thinking about now because I'm appreciating 40 years ago what it took to do that. Because today it would be computer-generated, correct? Mm-hmm. Or be robotic or something.
Yeah. Well, what's particularly interesting about what you've just said about all the making-of materials is that Jaws is also innovative in that it helped launch what we've now come to take for granted, which is these making-of stories. Right in 1975, when the film came out, Carl Gottlieb, one of the actors in that scene we just played, and one of the screenwriters, published a book called The Jaws Log. And this was really one of the first of its kinds, a book about the making of the film. And then, of course, not too long after that, we started getting these collections of stories put into a documentary about the making of. And Jaws was really one of the first films to have that amount of material about how the film was made.
Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to see it because I didn't want to spoil it.
But
you guys are film aficionados. You need to know this stuff. So.
And I don't mind. I'm kind of fascinated by all of that. And it certainly speaks to this issue of Spielberg's genius, his ability to make something out of what would, in any other director's hands or lesser director's hands, would be a failure. Because the mechanical shark was so fake-looking, he was forced to revise the story and also made the story much, much stronger, which is the thing that is lacking in so many blockbusters today. Its character, its narrative, it's these three guys and their interactions. I think that's why the film is so watchable again and again. It's not just the predictable, you know, by now, thrills. Even though every time I watch it, I jump at the same places, even though I know they're coming. But it's this idea of relying on the writerly aspects of filmmaking because all of those thrills are, you know, inaccessible to you. If you're counting on that shark looking real, what are you going to do?
Boy, that's really interesting what you're saying. He knew the limitations of it. If there was a lot of shark in this movie, people wouldn't find it believable, right?
And so they, you know,
when's the first time we actually see Bruce in Jaws?
Well, I actually have a clip of that very moment, and that's when the Kintner boy, the young boy, the first kill that we actually see happen on screen, and we barely see the shark. So we just get a hint of it in the tradition of the grand old monster movies of the past, where you just see a little tiny bit of the monster on screen. And this is a scene right after the scene we just heard, where Chief Brody has been told he can't close the beaches. So he's uptight on the beach, knowing that he should have closed them, looking at all these people get into the water. And all of a sudden, this little boy on a raft is attacked by the shark. And it's the first time we actually get a glimpse of the shark.
We know all about you, Chief. You don't go in the water at all, do you?
Some bad hat, Harry.
Chief Brody, you are uptight. Come on. That's it.
Pippet! 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 Come on, Pippet! Pippet!
So that is the first moment with the great ostinato chords by John Williams. And this is a film that really made his career as well. And that final chord that we just heard is another brilliant moment in the scene. It's what's been called the vertigo shot, which is where he's dollying forward and zooming out with the lens at the same time. It's that moment of realization.
Oh, what did you call it? Dolly forward and zoom out.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Right. It's the reverse of what Alfred Hitchcock did in Vertigo, where he dollied backward and zoomed in. And it's this wonderful moment of realization. Shows Spielberg's, you know, great visual flair and ability to tell a story, and it scares the hell out of you. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that music, John Williams' genius, and the simplicity of the music, and yet the all that's tied up in that. Every time you hear it now, right? I wanted to ask you about the next clip because when to me the first time that the shark seems real to me, maybe it's correct. Because you just saw the film again recently, didn't you?
I
didn't watch it. I got to watch it again. When you see the whole shark swimming around the boat, there's a shot from up above. I think that's pretty believable to me.
Right, and that's about an hour later in
is
the film,
really?
And that's the first time we see the full body, and that's a powerful moment. I agree. Yeah. That's really powerful.
When Robert Shaw is looking at it.
That's right, yeah.
And they're trying to estimate the length of the shark.
Yeah, right. 25 feet.
Richard Dreyfuss says that's a 20-footer.
Yeah. 25.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
You're going to need a bigger boat. A line improvised by Roy Scheider, by the way, that wasn't in the script. Yeah.
I want to ask our listeners to call in today and share this conversation with us. I am wondering about the first time you saw Jaws and your reaction to it, and there's a particular scene that always scares you, even though you've seen it 10 or 12 times by now. 410-662-8780 is our number. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. If you're up on Martha's Vineyard or Amity on Long Island, give us a ring. Chris, what do you have next?
Well, just one thing about Martha's Vineyard. It is pretty amazing that this film was made on the island, that this entire Hollywood film crew relocated itself for the summer months to Martha's Vineyard, and it's part of what gives the film its authenticity, because we really are on an island in the middle of the ocean. Of course, it made the production very difficult. So what I have next, you just mentioned Robert Shaw, and this is the first time that we see Robert Shaw. Originally, Spielberg was interested in casting Sterling Hayden, but he had some tax problems that was keeping him out of the country.
And Lee Marvin.
And Lee Marvin, very true.
Oh, actually see either one, I guess. Shaw.
Shaw's wonderful. So he plays Quint the Shark Hunter, and we're in the town hall when everyone's arguing because the Kintner boy has been killed. They can't deny that there's a shark. And they're all arguing about what to do, and all of a sudden we hear the horrible sound of nails on a chalkboard as Quint gets everyone's attention to announce how he can catch the shark.
You all know me. Know how I earn a living. I'll catch this bird for you, but it ain't gonna be easy. It's bad fish. Not like going down the pond chasing bluegills or tommy cats. This shark, swallow you whole. Shaking, tenderizing, down you go. And we gotta do it quick. That'll bring back the tourists. That'll put all your businesses on a paying basis. But it's not gonna be pleasant. I value my neck a lot more than $3,000, Chief. I'll fine him for $3,000, but I'll catch him and kill him for $10. You gotta make up your minds. You want to stay alive and ante up? You want to play it cheap? Be on welfare the whole winter.
Chris and Linda are lip-syncing the words. They know all the words in this movie.
Shark will swallow you whole.
Robert Shaw. Now, I remember Robert Shaw from The Sting, the Newman Redford film. Was that before?
Yes.
Which that
was also produced by Zanuck and Brown.
Oh, really?
So, in a way, they could afford, at that point, from that spectacular success, to invest in Spielberg and this project when it seemed as if everything was going south.
It's a great performance.
Robert Shaw is also the blonde bad guy in the James Bond film From Russia with Love.
His hair is blonde, and that's right, yeah. All right, Chris, I'm ready for another one.
Sure. So we haven't met Richard Dreyfuss yet, so let's say hi to him. So he plays...
Excuse me. What did we know about Richard Dreyfuss by 1975?
Well, he'd been in American Graffiti. He's one of the two leads. And he had a film that was coming out around the time Jaws was shooting called something Duddy Kravitz.
The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz.
Yeah. But he was really known to American audiences for American Graffiti, although he'd been kicking around a little bit. Linda reminded me the other day that he makes a brief appearance in The Graduate. Very brief. So he'd been around for a bit, but it was the the mid-70s that really established him as a star. So he plays Hooper from the Oceanographic Institute, although in real life, Dreyfuss had never been on a boat before making this film. And so he's the shark expert, and he shows up and is horrified to find out that the town authorities are denying that the first death, Chrissy, was caused by a shark. And so here he is in the clinic where they're keeping the body, examining for himself the body.
The left arm, head, shoulders, sternum, and portions of the rib cage are intact. Do not smoke in here, thank you very much. This is what happens. It indicates the non-frenzied feeding of a large squalus, possibly Longimanus or Asurus glaucus. Now, the enormous amount of tissue loss prevents any detailed analysis. However, the attacking squalus must be considerably larger than any normal squalus found in these waters. Didn't you get on a boat and check out these waters? Well, this is not a boat accident. It wasn't any propeller. It wasn't any coral reef. And it wasn't Jack the Ripper. It was a shark.
He's really good, isn't he?
He's fantastic. That,
yeah. We have the clip where he's going to get in the cage, and Shaw says, you get in the cage will go in the water. We have that clip?
I don't think
in the water, you're in the cage
I
in the water.
I don't think I brought that clip. I'm
that's
sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. Boy, that's a really good scene there. Yeah. Thank you very much. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here for your scariest moment in Jaws. Your experiences with Jaws over the years. We're going to take a call in just a moment. We got an email from Jeff. It says, we're going to the beach in a week. My soon-to-be 11-year-old son is a voracious reader. Should I just have him read the Peter Benchley book, or should I put the movie on for him and his 7-year-old brother? I don't know what I'd do with this. I'm trying to remember when I let my kids watch Jaws.
Ouch.
I think my kids were that age when I let them watch Jaws.
Yeah, well, whatever you do, don't let them read the book. The book is really not very good. The film, as Steven Spielberg himself made very public, the book is far inferior to the film. It's a masterpiece. The book is just a kind of, you know.
Didn't the book have more sex in it, too?
Yes.
Yes, there's an affair between characters who don't have an affair in the movie. And one of the characters in the book dies, who doesn't die in the movie.
Let's take a couple of calls here before our next break. John in Annapolis, for your Jaws memory, go right ahead.
Yes, hello?
Yeah, go ahead, John. Your Jaws memory, please.
Well, I was 8 years old the day it came out. I had no idea what was in store for me. And my mother and my aunt, like my cousin and I, to see it. We waited in line for 5 hours because the first show was sold out. I lived on Galveston Island. And I remember I got there. I didn't know what the movie was about or anything. I just knew it was going to be scary. And I'm standing and looking at the poster for about 3 hours while I'm waiting for the movie. And so for the rest of the next 2 years, I didn't go swimming in the water. But I did see the movie 10 times that summer.
Did you really?
Yes, 10 times. So I had every line memorized like your guest. And all the impacts it had as far as like the soundtrack, who made the movie. It was sort of like the Citizen Kane of monster movies because of all these new angles that he used that made you feel like you were in the water. And my question is actually, there's been some talk about rebooting the franchise or remaking the movie, which would seem nearly impossible, just like the Jurassic Park franchise. And what advice would your guests have to somebody who was thinking about trying to reboot the franchise?
I wouldn't be surprised if someone did try to do that.
Yeah, I would say don't do it.
Of course,
there were already, I think, at least 3 sequels, including the last one, Jaws the Revenge, which had the only good part about it is the ridiculous tagline, "This time it's personal." And by that time, Roy Scheider was long gone from the series to be replaced by Michael Caine, and it's not a good film.
The best part about going to see the film multiple times in the summer of 75 is that you could, the second time or third time you went, you could bring someone with you who hadn't seen it yet. Mm-hmm. And so you could sit there and enjoy, be in anticipation of how they would react at certain scenes. I remember doing that with my brother, Eddie. He was really scared. Tony in Catonsville, welcome to the show. Go right ahead. Hi.
Hi, Dan. Yeah, this is so much fun. I was in my mid-20s, actually, in Rochester, New York. And I was only 2 weeks away from going to Cape Cod for vacation for the first time. So I went to see it with my mother. I think my sister may have also joined us. But anyway, my mother loved these kinds of movies, loved to be scared to death. And we were waiting in line, you know, like you said, a blockbuster, waiting to get in. And I said to myself, do I want to do this? Do I want to do this? And we get up, we get our ticket, we get in our seat, the theater's dark, it's going dark, do I want to do this? Can I do it? And she's like, man up, you can do it. And that music starts, and I thought, I pay for the ticket, I'm going to do it. So I'm so impressionable. I was terrified. Loved the movie, but loved being scared, just like my mom. I think they cured me of it. And then went to the vacation in Cape Cod, stayed on the beach, did not go in the water, but went into the water on the bayside and thinking, oh, this is fine, it's the bay, whatever. And then, of course, when did Spielberg, was it Jaws 2, introduce the great white on the bayside?
That's this one.
Yeah, no, actually, the shark shows up on the bayside where the kids are in the small dinghy, right?
That's right. Yeah, there's a moment in Jaws where he goes into the bay.
Yeah. Yes.
I forget Jaws 2, so I don't know if there's that in there, too.
You did not learn your lesson.
Yeah, see that, Tony? No, that was in the original film.
You know, and you're right. Now with all the shark attacks or whatever, I'm older now, and I can't swim my way out of it. I can't. So I maybe go up to my ankles, and that's about it.
Still.
It's a great movie, though, and you're right about the performances. Just terrific, terrific performances. Any of those other selections in the actors would not have made the same great movie, I really think. Oh.
Makes me want to see the film now. By the way, is it in release again?
Yes.
What's the deal?
Yeah, it's kind of a roadshow.
Yeah, the Senators having two screenings of it on July 8th and 12th, and AVAM, American Visionary Art Museum, is doing an outdoor screening on July 9th. Beyond that,
oh,
in the local area, I don't know.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, we'll take a break here. We'll come back and talk some more with Linda DeLibero and Christopher Llewellyn Reed. It's our Jaws special, looking back 40 years to the release of Jaws in 1975. Please share your memory, 410-662-8780.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him Jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version of Peter Benchley's best-selling novel, Jaws.
So we would have seen that in the theater.
Or on TV. Or on TV, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What a voice that guy has.
Percy Rodriguez, you said.
Yeah.
Boy, anything.
Beautiful.
The opening scene is in there.
That's right. That moment. Chrissy's. I forget the actress's name, but she's a local islander.
Yeah.
For me, that is the most primal moment.
Isn't it?
When you hear her go.
Yeah. And isn't there, I believe
under.
In there, there's like a hammer hitting an anvil or something.
The sound of,
yeah, to me, it's always been a metallic sound.
Well, because she gets shoved up against the buoy.
The buoy, no. Yeah. But no, the Jaws sound, to me, it sounds
metallic.
Check it out later.
Yeah, yeah.
To me, it's like a hammer on an anvil.
Yeah,
with
sharp teeth, yeah.
Yeah. Jerome in Baltimore, let's take your call next. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a point of note, Percy Rodriguez, who did the voiceover, was an accomplished actor in his own right. He was a black actor, and he did a lot of films, a lot of TV.
Huh.
But I just wanted to share that I was a kid growing up in Lower East Baltimore, and my aunt took me to see the film, and I was so excited about it that I snatched up one of my friends. We caught the number 8 bus from Lower Baltimore all the way out to the center of the theater to see it, and I just could not wait to see his reaction in the film. The two scariest moments for me was when the head popped out of the boat. They were searching for someone, and the head popped. the head pops out of a boat.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and the whole theater just went, And when Robert Shaw was devoured and he was trying to kick his way away, and you really wanted to see him kind of kick away from the shark and live.
Yeah.
But, that
makes me sad. Yeah, I still get bummed out when Quint goes down.
Oh,
But I got to say, the scene that he's talking about when Richard Driver's in scuba gear, he's checking out a half-sunken fishing boat, right?
Ben Gardner's boat, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that fake
You remember
head.
The fisherman's name?
Yeah, yeah.
The guy I was talking to this morning who was born in 1979, he remembered his name, too. And then poor Ben Gardner.
His head
just, oh, my God, I jumped out of my chair.
And
I really did.
It's
I really
a brilliant
remember.
Moment because up until this point, Richard Dreyfuss's character, Hooper, has been totally in control, knows everything. He's a smart ass. He's got all the high-tech equipment. And he goes under and he sees that head pop out and he comes up and he's totally speechless. Yeah. And he can't deal with it.
What's
great.
Interesting, too, is that Spielberg went back and reworked that moment after initial preview screenings. Because he didn't think it was scary enough. And so he went back and in Verna Fields, the editor's swimming pool, reshot that insert of Ben Gardner's head that would come in and scare the audience. And he then got the scare he wanted. But he said what was interesting is that because of that scare that he worked over to make even more frightening than before, he lost the power of the scare when the shark jumps out of the water and Roy Scheider says, we're going to need a bigger boat. That's still scary, but he said he noticed in preview screenings after he reworked the Ben Gardner moment that the power of that second moment was reduced because the audience didn't trust him anymore. That was his take on that.
The audience didn't trust him anymore.
That's right. So in other words, it was still effective,
yeah.
But not as effective.
Interesting.
But he was good with that.
Yvonne in White Marsh. Yvonne, welcome to Midday.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
What did you want to say about Jaws?
Not only is it my awesome all-time favorite movie, I have a poster that I actually got about 4 years ago at a yard sale of one of the original posters of Jaws. I have the book, and I also have the movie.
So you're into, and how often would you say you watch this movie, Yvonne? Once a year?
To be honest, at least once every other month.
Oh, really? Really? You really like it that much, huh?
I am a huge fan. I'm originally from Abington, Pennsylvania, and I'll never forget when my mom took my sister and I was about 9. My sister was 7. And she was a little apprehensive at first because she didn't know how we would react to it. But after watching it, I don't know, some 40-plus years later, it's my all-time favorite movie.
Well, I guess it would be in my... Thank you very much, Yvonne. You know, when someone would say, name your all-time favorite movies, I don't know if you'd put that in there, right?
It still doesn't get a lot of critical respect. I've noticed in anthologies of film criticism and film theory.
Because it's so popular.
Yes, it's too popular. And it was that film that a lot of people at the time complained of sort of ending the era of the great 70s mm-hmm. movies. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Spielberg went on to make films that, lesser or greater value. I would argue that this is his greatest film in terms of pure cinematic value.
So this is my question for you. What is Spielbergian about Jaws? What endures? What is it about that? What makes it Spielbergian?
You know, it's funny you say Spielbergian. I realized, especially this time watching it again, how much he learned from Hitchcock. To me, it seems like a very Hitchcockian film. And it right up from the very beginning, when you have the sounds of the animals beneath the sea, that's exactly the way The Birds begins, with those sort of mechanical sounding bird noises. But I think the thing that shows his strength is that ability to manipulate an audience, to be able to work them over. The fact of his tinkering with that moment of the head coming out shows you that he's very aware of how audiences will react, and he can really use that. And that is, I think, a very Spielbergian trait that he derived from Hitchcock.
Yes, I absolutely agree, especially the part about manipulating the audience. And, you know, Spielberg has always been a storyteller, and he's always made films with consummate craft. And so Jaws is a meticulously made film. Now, thanks in large part to the wonderful editor, Verna Fields. He didn't make this alone. But if there is a Spielbergian element in here, it's the sort of brilliance of the camera and how the camera works to serve the story and not just through flourishes of its own for their own sake.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call before we hear another clip. Catherine in Pikesville, your comment about Jaws, please. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead, Catherine.
Hi. So much like Smaltimore, like a previous guest, I lived in Galveston when I first saw Jaws. And I actually lived on an island off of Galveston, the Gulf of Mexico, and we begged my mom to go see it. She had a crush on Robert Shaw, so that's why we ended up seeing it. But it affected my life very much afterwards because we lived on an island, we got around in a boat, and I could not think of sharks all day long. But later in life, I went to film school, and I just kind of collected a group of people around me that loved the movie as much as I do. I even did a paper about comparing it to Hitchcock, too. So I've loved the movie my whole life, and I kind of turned it around where I became obsessed with sharks. My kids, we love sharks. Shark Week, we watch everything, and we have a little app where we track the sharks up and down the East Coast, the one that was just in the Potomac River.
Really?
It was kind of exciting, yeah.
How popular, thank you very much for that call, Catherine, how popular sharks have become. Shark Week on, what channel is that, mm-hmm. Discovery Channel?
Discovery Channel, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Chris, one more clip for
us? I wanted to play the famous USS Indianapolis speech, which the guy delivering it, Robert Shaw, basically wrote. It wasn't his idea. It was John Milius and another screenwriter who worked on the screenplay. But Robert Shaw ultimately wrote the speech that we're going to hear. He was a playwright in his own right. And this is when we discover exactly why Robert Shaw's character, Quint, hates sharks so much.
Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes to the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark would go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eye. When he comes at you, doesn't seem to be living until he bites you, and those black eyes roll over white, and then, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in, they rip you to pieces.
Powerful stuff.
Yeah. Very powerful.
This is what distinguishes this film from subsequent blockbuster films.
Yeah.
There's that great piece of history. You can see the beginnings of Spielberg's World War II obsession.
Yep.
And
70 years ago, next month, I believe, the Indianapolis disaster. Or August. I can't remember. July, August. What did he say? I think he said July.
Yeah, I think so.
Can't remember the exact
1945.
Date. Anyway, June 20th, 1975 was the release of Jaws. And as Chris mentioned, July 8th and 12th, it'll be at the Senator Theater. And the American Visionary Arts Museum is having a...
On the 9th.
On the 9th of July.
Yeah, a Flicks on the Hill outdoor screening.
Well, that's excellent. As we listen to the credits music, the music of the credits from John Williams. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. It was great fun.
Llewellyn Reed, Linda DeLibro, thank you very much for this show.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great weekend.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.